Good afternoon. Welcome to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
We're glad you're with us today. We've got a great show for you lined up. I tell you what, our guest today, what an amazing guy. His name is Guy, actually, which is really interesting. Guy Iannuzzi. He's from Mentis. It's a company that is, it's the Mad Men of today. The advertising agency, the big time, the real cool advertising agency of today. The list of clients this guy's had reads like the best of the best of Biz Talk over the last 20 years. Very excited about it. Maybe we can find out some secrets of... I think advertising people know a lot more about us than we know about ourselves sometimes. How to get us to do things.
Absolutely.
Like buy stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
It's psychological.
Yeah. So we're going to talk with Guy in just a few minutes. Before we get to Guy, though, I'm very, very interested in a couple of topics that I'd like to begin a dialogue on. First of all, the word of the week.
What was the word of the week again?
Digihoarder.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's your word,
that
Montana.
That is my word. Yeah. Anybody that's obsessive about downloading digital media and hoarding that media and duplicating that media in case it...
Back it up again.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And this is the backing up of the unnecessary things, not the documents you have
on your computer. I just have 11 terabytes of video.
But the unimportant thing, it's okay.
He does.
It's okay if you lose it. You know, what's the worst
thing?
There's hours upon hours of...
A video that I'll never watch.
That you'll never watch.
So here's something interesting. Everybody knows there's a kilobyte, which is 1,000 bytes, a megabyte, which is a million bytes, and then there's
a
gigabyte, and then terabyte. What's after terabyte?
Petabyte.
What's after petabyte?
Zettabyte.
No idea.
Etabyte. What's after etabyte?
Are
Zettabyte.
We making these up?
Zettabyte. No, these are real.
This is true.
I'm the only person here that doesn't know.
Yeah.
And I'm the youngest, too. There's a problem with this.
That's right.
What's after zettabyte?
I'm going to guess it starts with a Q. For whatever reason, those the obscure letters.
Nope. Yettabyte.
Of course. Yettabyte.
Yettabyte. So... Petabyte, etabyte, zettabyte, yettabyte. After, woohoo!
Do we know how much data is being stored out there in the ether world?
I have no idea, but it's a number bigger than my brain can wrap around right now. So I'm a digihoarder.
Yes, you are.
In fact, it's so bad I have trouble hitting the backspace key. Because once the letter's on the screen, it's
gone
there,
forever.
And I don't want to lose it, because, wow.
We can get you help.
I hope you're exaggerating about that much.
Yes, I am. I really do save a lot of data, though, and I find a lot. And I'm one of those guys that explores the dark net. Have you ever been on the dark net yet?
No, but you've told me all
the
about it.
The web behind the web,
I won't
the
go
deep
there.
Web.
Because you can't unsee it.
You can't go there. I know, but there's so many cool things if you're careful about what you do. I mean, it's really designed for communications for the Navy, for their agents. That's what, so they could phone home from anywhere in the world and not get tracked. But who's using it now are dissidents in different countries. And I had an ongoing conversation once with somebody that claimed to be from North Korea. Now, you have no way of verifying it, but I had to use Google Translate to communicate with them. And as long as we stayed, I think we kept the line open for 3 days. And we talked, and it was one of the most interesting 3 days. I have no way of knowing if this person really was from North
Korea.
Was
there anything notable they told you about life in North Korea? I mean, that you wouldn't have...
The person I was talking with claimed to be a guy and claimed to want to know what the real world was like outside. Mm. Because they had some kind of inkling that things weren't the way they were told. So we spent most of the time talking about what life was like in another country and what life was like for them. So it was a fascinating conversation. Then I think that I lost power or something, a circuit break, and then the computer shut down.
So once they're gone, you can never get
them
back.
There's no way to find them again. At least I had no way to do it. But anyhow, digihoarder, that's what I am.
And proud of it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about money. Most of the shows that you listen to on here, the business shows, are about money.
Yes.
But the people that are on before us, they're all financial people,
yes.
Right?
Right.
And I've got 35 years of experience in that industry. And some things that are really bothering me about society today, and a big one, actually, Aaron, is something you introduced me to, a concept that I think applies to a lot of anxiety people have about money these days. And what I think happens to us is there's so much information coming our way about the stock market, the bond market, what's happening in China, what's happening in North Korea, what's happening in the United States. The information that we get is so overwhelming yes. today that it's really difficult to know what to do with your dollars. And everybody says that they've got the right way to accumulate money for retirement. They've got the right way for you to buy insurance. They've got the right way. And if you don't do it right, you're bad. And I think, Aaron, the concept you introduced me to that I think is not a new concept. I just had never applied it to this. Decision fatigue.
Yeah. Decision fatigue is something we talk a lot about, or at least millennials do, about these things called life hacks, right? So things that'll make your life easier, make you more efficient. Technology is one way that we're doing that. And I was reading about people like Steve Jobs and people like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. And if you look at them every day, Steve Jobs was wearing a black turtleneck. Every day,
never
Mark
thought
Zuckerberg
about it until you
is
said
wearing
that.
A sweatshirt. And that's a conscious decision that they're taking these decisions that other people have to think about and erasing them from their lives. Mm-hmm. So they're just making this an automatic thing. So the idea is that all of these routine things, and some people take it to extreme, like I'm going to eat the same thing every day. So you open your cupboard. But the idea that you exhaust yourself with these small things throughout the day.
I struggle with figuring out what socks to wear.
Yeah.
Because I like socks. So I go through like 20 different sets to figure out.
And you never think later on in the day when a really important thing comes up and you might be struggling to have the mental capacity to deal with it, it might be because you couldn't decide what socks to wear that morning. I mean, that might have something to do with the fact that you're struggling with making
And then
that
there's
decision.
People like me that wonder why you have a pair of socks, a pair of pants, a pair of underwear, a pair of shoes, a pair of gloves, a pair of glasses. But you don't have a pair of shirts.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
And that bothers me. So while I'm deciding which socks to wear, I'm debating why we don't have a pair of shirts.
Yeah. I mean, that's a different conversation.
I know,
for like
but see, it chains to that when you're making decisions about socks. So I think decision fatigue actually hurts people when they're trying to make decisions about what to do. So it becomes problematic when you're younger and you've got time to save. How much do you put in? Where do you put it? 401k, IRA, outside? Do you buy real estate? Do you buy stocks? Do you buy bonds? Do you put money in a hedge fund? Do you do this? Do you do that? It becomes overwhelming. And the way we make decisions today is really difficult in that you have to get information from somewhere. And a lot of people are getting it from the internet. And as we know, if you read it on the internet, it's got to be true, right?
100%.
So it's confusing. I can't believe I've just exhausted our entire first segment talking about decision fatigue.
That's okay.
And why we
back.
Don't have a pair of shirts.
We can come back.
The fact that I'm a digital hoarder. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
When we come back, a really fascinating guy, Guy Iannuzzi. Mentis is his company. He knows how we make decisions. He'll tell us. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. We're broadcasting today from the ESET studios. ESET Internet Security, do more. Want a podcast of this show? Of course you do. Go to ESPN1700.com. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. And we want you to listen to the podcast because we need our ratings. And if you're not part of the Nielsen rating system, you don't have one of those little beeper things, the way you can help us with our ratings on the show, boy, this is begging, isn't it? A shameless plug.
It's okay.
Go to the podcast. You got to have it on. You got to listen to it within the first 24 hours. And you got to listen at least 5 minutes. So even if you don't pay attention, run it for 5 minutes. Get us a brownie point. Get our ratings up. Then we can sell more advertising, do more things, have more fun. Life is better. Life is good.
And you get to hear us for longer.
Whew. Guy Iannuzzi is with us. Mentis is his company. He is the modern day madman from Mad Men. Guy, welcome to Biz Talk.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. I really appreciate being here. I've been listening to your broadcasts over this last bit of time, actually.
So we had a listener.
Yes, you had a listener, and you're right. To see so many of the people in the community here that I respect and I'm in awe of come here and really unburden themselves in terms of what makes them tick, what makes their passions fly, and what makes their endeavors succeed. And it makes me really clear this is one incredible community.
I believe so. Now, Mentis is an ad agency, right? Advertising agency, marketing company. What do you call yourself?
Well, it's kind of an interesting discussion. I'm not really a madman because the truth is advertising is one of the smallest things we do, and okay. It's the least. We do actually a remarkable small amount of advertising in the traditional sense. We were founded as a design and branding agency working for investor relations. So what we do is, a better way to look at it is this way. When a company wants to get funded, an entrepreneur creates a company, he or she need to get investors, need to get people to come on board. And it's either investors can be mom and pop or their friends or a venture firm or Wall Street investors, depending on the size of the enterprise. Or it can even be another company that wants to invest in them. So by a lot of fortuitous things, I got involved in that issue. And we learned how to appeal to an investor in a branding and marketing sense using advertising and marketing tools, but orient them to entrepreneurs. And these entrepreneurs mostly that had no products at that stage, early stage companies typically are not marketing to customers. Now they have something that ultimately will go to a customer, but they're trying to get people on board to invest in the company saying, hey, we know how to get to these customers.
Now, normally you think of investor relations associated with a public company,
correct.
A company that's listed on some exchange that everybody can buy stock in or buy an interest in. But what I think I hear you saying is that investor relations aren't just for public companies.
Correct.
There are private companies that still have to have an investor relations department for the investors they're bringing in, whether it's venture capital or private money or funding from some other source. Is that correct?
You're correct. Except I wouldn't say public. Department. Typically, they have to have their eye on the ball or on the prize in that a young company, early stage company, needs investors more desperately than a mature Fortune 500 company. Now, I might point out, we're one of the larger national players in large public company investor relations. We've been involved 140 plus IPOs in our history, and we have companies like Cisco, companies like Ryder, the big trucking company, and so on, and Aramark have been our clients. But the reality is when you're starting a company, you have a desperate need for an investor. An investor can be one individual, it can be an venture firm. And so what makes it interesting is that you have the same paradigm, but you're talking to fewer people and you could be a little more direct. And so you need to talk to them verbally. You need to make a presentation. You need to go through an exercise. And nowadays, you need to have something on your website. So we are very, very experienced in enabling an early stage entrepreneur to connect with the people that he or she need to connect with to make their organization grow.
So one of the things that fascinates me is most of the companies started in the United States are started by somebody who has a craft or they're a scientist and they start a biotech company, or they're a carpenter, they start a construction company. So they have a craft or a trade that they are good at, and they end up starting a company, and then they realize that 80% of what they're doing is not hammering or at the lab. It's raising money, doing payroll, doing administration, management, exactly. Yeah. When you work with the early stage companies, how often do people at that level, just getting a company going, actually understand the need for investor relations? Actually get that as part of their business model?
Well, the title investor relations for that early stage person may not even exist in their mindset. But usually, by the time they come to us, they've already had the struggle in trying to raise some money. I mean, already, they don't come to us, oh, we've had clients where here's a business plan, and can you help us go to the next step? But typically, we're not involved there. We typically are involved when they already have had the struggle and had a Series A or have had friends and family round. You know, typically, they'll mortgage their home and get their wife.
So they've
or
already
their
raised a half a million or a million
precisely.
Bucks. Precisely. Right
there. But that only gets them a little bit of traction, as you can imagine.
Yeah, because I could burn through $1 million with a company pretty quick.
Oh, no, and most
yeah.
people do.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems that entrepreneurs have. And that's another conversation in terms of what we call the Valley of Death, where companies have enough to get started, but don't have enough to make the next tranche.
Now,
the next,
Are they working with you? Do you just have a Rolodex and act as a middleman? It sounds more to me like you actually help them craft a message that will attract investors as well. Do people recognize that they need... Because most founders, they're the ones, they think they tell the story better than anybody else. So why are they going to listen? Right? Why are they going to listen to you about, hey, this is the message that we should be sending to investors, and this is why it's going to make sense for them, and they're going to like what they're hearing?
Aaron, you nailed it, and that is exactly the problem. Typically, a person who creates a company in a technology, especially in the technology area, but any area, usually does it with a right sense that they know a lot about that area because that's the opportunity and they know more about it than somebody else may know about it. But the tools that let you craft the device or the technology are absolutely not the tools. And sometimes they're opposite tools of what you need to communicate on that side.
And so they might not be able to tell their story well to investors.
Precisely.
They
some
might be
know
really
that.
Good at what they're doing, but they just can't tell the story.
Some know that, some do not. And if you speak to the venture community, this is one of their biggest problems. And their big problem is they'll have a company that's a worthy company for an investment, and they think that's fantastic technology, but the founders both, oh my God, we can't put them in front of an investor because they don't know how to communicate, et cetera, whatever. Now, some do. Now, you have a lot of serial entrepreneurs that have had and San Diego is blessed with a whole bunch that you know.
Right.
And Bob, you know them actually very well, that have had 4, 5, 10, 15, even 20 companies. And they typically are people who have that gift and that ability. But nonetheless, they learn to go to an expert who says, hey, somebody who really knows how to do it, has done it for hundreds of companies like we have, and crafting that thing so it makes it easier for me. It's why would you outsource payroll? Why? Because I have other things to do. Why do you outsource everything else in running the company except the very thing you do?
Guy, let me ask you to hold that thought. We've got to go to a break. Guy Iannuzzi is with us. Mentis is his company. They're a company that does a lot but focuses on investor relations for companies to help them tell their story better. I think I might have got that right this time. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
When we come back, a lot more for you. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. You're listening to us on ESPN 1700, but did you know you can watch us too? Watch us on Facebook, visit our Biz Talk Radio page, share your comments, ask your questions, and of course, Bob always appreciates your likes. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. Glad you're with us today. We have a fascinating guy in studio with us, Guy Iannuzzi. His company is Mentis. I haven't quite nailed what you do correctly, Guy. You did investor relations and branding of the company for not just investors, but for general the world in general. But we were kind of focusing on investor relations when we went to the break, and you were kind of leading us down the path of how companies tell their story and what you do to help them brand. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct. And, you know, it's funny. People think that a branding thing is what a mature company like a Procter & Gamble, who has got enormous market niches and thousands of consumer products, you need branding. You know, what's that got to do with us? You know, we're just a startup company with, you know, nobody's ever heard of, with a technology that's very esoteric and hard to understand. And my comment is, if anybody ever needed branding, it's you. Because what branding does is that it simplifies things that are difficult to remember and understand in a way that your mind instantly associates with whatever that is, that thing. It's an image, a picture, a word, a phrase. It's like saying Nike, for example. You know, you could say, well, Nike is a shoe. And it's a shoe that is ergonomically very well designed. It's really technologically very incredibly sophisticated. You know, nowadays, you know what it is? It's just do it. It's just do
it. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, a million associations about the value of that brand hit you across the head. So you're doing a company that does antisense oligonucleotides, and you're, you know, a researcher.
Say what?
You're doing a technology that is going to be used in personal medicine or precision medicine or whatever. Right. I want to go there only because it's hot today, and I'll describe later maybe an example of what's going on in that area, or in immuno-oncology. And these are areas that are difficult, even if you're an immunologist or oncologist, to understand, because the differentiation is minute. And
so how in the world does an investor understand it?
Bingo. And that is the problem. So what we have is that, you know, maybe some investors, some analysts have a background in bioscience, but most are bankers. They're finance people. They're people with venture people on that end. And then as they get to larger discussions, because they have to get their limited partners on board in terms of the syndicate, in terms of the investment proposition, our job is to find a way of knowing what that investor in particular, that institutional investor, whether it's a Fidelity or whatever, knowing what's of interest to them and seeing whether this company fulfills that interest and what part of their market positioning in terms of what they're going to go to. Okay, this thing is going to be for glioblastoma. And this is because this is a cancer that has only about a 7% survival rate. I mean, typically, and even less than that, 3% on that end. So it's an incredible unmet need. And this is an opportunity that could be worth billions of dollars. So it's not just about making money. It's also about filling a medical need. And this particular company, in this particular set of technologies, can get there quicker because it's maybe safer. It may be easier to manufacture. You know, it's a billion reasons. Our job with the company, and get this, we get it from the company. It's not, we're not geniuses. We don't figure it out. We talk to them and say, but we don't get enmeshed in the incredible details, because we're not bench chemists or bench biologists. What we do is we say, okay, we know what the market wants. We know what market tools work. I mean, I actually published an article today on LinkedIn about perceptual engrams, that people use shortcuts to have opinions. And with Trump today, we have, this is really a truism that's really comes home. People do not want to work intellectually very hard because we are too busy. We want to come to an opinion right quickly. We don't want to think deeply about something and think hard and then, oh, and then I can figure it out. We don't want to figure it out. We want to instantly come to an opinion.
You know, you said something a few sentences back that I'd like to go back to that was a little bit of new information for me. When I think about a company that's looking to raise capital, I think about figuring out what that company needs and finding the money for that company. What I heard you say is, you know what the investors, the people that have the money, what they're looking for, and you match the company to them, which is a different model than I think most of us think about. We think about finding the money for this idea, for this money, rather than finding the investor and knowing what they need and finding the company that matches that. So you're looking at both sides of the equation, not just one.
You have to look at both sides. I mean, granted, a company has certain needs and have to find a certain kind of investor that will fulfill that. But the marketing premise, the pure marketing premise, is about the customer, whether it's an investor or whatever. And you have to be in the brain of the customer. You have to be customer-centric. And people say, of course, of course. Well, doesn't that apply in finance? Just because you're not selling soap, that means that if you're selling an investment, don't you think you need to be in the mind of the investor? Because who's the customer in an investment?
Understanding their needs is always...
Precisely. And when you do, then you have to look at what the company is looking to do, what their offering is specifically, and saying, okay, is that fit? Does it fit automatically? And usually it doesn't. Obviously, if they have a problem, it's not fitting, because they'll come to us or they'll come to an outside organization when it's not working.
So who pays you? In other words, you're looking at both sides of the equation. You've got the investors over here that have a need for their portfolio.
Right.
They're looking for a certain kind of company. You know what companies are out there, but the company's also looking for a certain kind of investor. You match them together. Which one pays you?
Oh, it's the company. It's always the company.
Always the company.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the venture they don't really like us, because they almost think of us as a spin doctor. They'll think, hey, come on, you know, I want to get to the heart. Analysts don't like us at all, because they feel like they don't need any of this simplification stuff. They understand already. And there may be some truth to that. But the reality is, especially when you become public, it has to be simplified, because you're dealing with thousands of investors on that end. And what we find is that level of simplification, frankly, works even at the earliest stages. And we have an example right now that I may have mentioned to you, a company called Kite Pharma.
Mm-hmm.
They just got acquired by Gilead last week for $11.9 billion. I mean, that's $12 billion.
Yeah.
And that's a fair amount of money.
That's a lot of money.
And it was a major evaluation of the company, far beyond what that company technically says would be worth in your mind. Well, this is a company we had the good fortune 2 years ago of doing exactly this. This is a company where we had to say it's a crowded field. There's a whole bunch of CAR-T companies in immuno-oncology. Hard to understand.
Are they a drug manufacturer?
Yes, they're a drug. Okay. They're providing a drug. They're creating a drug essentially to cure cancer. And it's one of the modalities that is actually very hot and people are feeling very, very good about. A lot of cancers that have actually no, other than chemotherapy, which was devastating,
right,
techniques to work, the CAR-T immuno-oncology areas really, really is starting to work across the board. So it's an area that the entire investment community is looking at. Not to mention large pharmaceutical companies, which I might point out, if you're a small biotech company, ultimately you have several exit strategies in terms of how you succeed as a company. One of them is to, we used to be the fully integrated model, which was, I'm going to create a company and I'm going to become another Amgen. I'm going to create and sell to customers and whatever, but that's a 10, 20 year term.
Guy, let me ask you to hold that thought again. We've got to go to another break. Guy Iannuzzi is with us. Mentis is his company. Boy, did they do a lot. I think this guy's got a lot of energy for this. Wow. Amazing stuff. We're going to learn more when we get back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
So much more when we get back. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. We'd like to take a moment to thank our engineer, Jeff Bilodeau, music by Derek Audette, our wonderful interns, Sarah, Andrew, Leah, Deidre, and Chrissy. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. We got no interns in today.
I know. We usually have an audience.
It feels lonely when they're not here.
It does.
And it's colder because we crank down the temperature, assuming there's going to be 50 people in the room.
I know, because when we have a lot of people in here, it gets hot in here. Of course, it's kind of warm in here today because the topics are hot. Oh, my God.
Yeah, the nice
segue. Did I resort to that?
Yes, you did.
I did, didn't I?
You did go there.
You got a pity laugh.
Wow.
And we got crickets. Thank you, Jeff.
We do have an amazing guest in studio, Guy Iannuzzi. He's with Mentis. It's his company. They do some amazing stuff, branding, investor relations. Guy, I want to get to the branding in just a second, but you were kind of on a roll before we went to the break about talking about the bio companies and their exit strategies.
Correct.
And building that in the kind of the beginning.
Sure. And as I was saying earlier, when an entrepreneur creates a company, he or she usually is looking at several options about how, if they succeed, how will they play out? And originally, in the 80s and 90s, people thought, great, we'll become another Amgen. We'll create a company, and ultimately, we'll become a huge company with a lot of products, and that's how we'll succeed.
Amgen, for those that don't know, is an amazingly successful biotech company that's developed so many different products.
Or think of Qualcomm. We're going to be a communications company, and Irwin Jacobs, I'm going to build a Qualcomm, and it's going to be his company, and it goes public. But the point is, it's one company that does everything. From a small company of three people, it becomes now a behemoth. The other option is, I'm going to do a company where we're going to do the technology, but we're never going to really sell it. We're going to have partners. And what we're going to do is, we're going to do this little engine that does all these products. And then we're going to get big partners that are distribution companies that will sell all over the world. I'll have our brand, or maybe I'll have their brand. It doesn't matter. It's like the Intel Inside kind of thing. Our technology will be there.
So nobody will ever know that. No consumers will know the name of that company, but in the industry, they could be well-known.
They could be well-known. And for the investment community, they know who they are. And we have, for example, a client that you consider might be a little like that. It's called Signet Jewelers, for example, in Akron. The world's largest
jeweler. What's the name of it?
Signet Jewelers in Akron,
Signet
Ohio.
Signet Jewelers.
Now, this is instructive. You had never heard of it.
I've never.
And 90% of our audience has never heard of it. Now, they're the world's largest jewelry company. And you're saying, Guy, how could that possibly be? And jewelry is a common thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone in this room likes jewelry.
Yes.
Right.
So let's look at it another way. You do know Kay's and Jared and Zales and a bunch of other companies. They're all owned by Signet.
No kidding.
And guess who the Signet agency is? Okay. So we are not, Kale, we are not Kay's or Jared or Zales at all. We do no other consumer branding. We, however, do the Wall Street branding, the investor branding for Signet. So that's the other play. I'm going to actually either own or have other companies that are going to market our products, and we're just going to be the center hub of that. Now, that's number two. Number three, or royalty. Some companies will do it as a royalty thing. I mean, a royalty stream. And that's called FIPCO. The first company will be a fully integrated pharmaceutical company, FIPCO. The second kind of company is called a RIPCO. That's a royalty integrated.
So they would create a product, sell the product to somebody for a royalty.
And somebody else. Pfizer would sell it.
That was the name I was going to bring up. So there are drugs on the market right now you might be buying that are under the Pfizer brand,
correct,
but not made by Pfizer, but because they have that name, they immediately have brand recognition.
Absolutely, and that is actually becoming now the more common thing, because the truth is it's very hard now to become a hugely large company in that end. However, you can have a terrific technology and have Merck and Pfizer and a whole bunch of other Genentech start to market your products, and it's a home run for you because you don't have to develop an infrastructure and do all that. And investors like it because it's a reasonable, realistic kind of model on that end.
And now, they don't have to raise the capital to put a distribution system together because Pfizer or the other big distribution companies already have that in play.
That is now the vogue. It used to be in the 90s, the reverse was the vogue.
You create a company, put your own sales force together, do everything yourself, and then you've got the cost of managing this huge sales force to sell to physicians or whatever they sell to.
I might point out, there's a third thing, which is interesting. You can start as a FIPCO. You can actually start as a fully integrated company. And I'll give you an example of this. There's a company called Dura Pharmaceuticals.
Cam
Gardner's company in San Diego in 1990. I might point out, it was the very first specialty pharmaceutical company in North America. And we had the privilege of launching a company at that time.
They made the asthma inhaler.
The asthma inhaler.
Spirulate. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Right.
And anyhow, what's interesting is that they developed their own sales force. They had up 250 sales reps across America and whatever. But interestingly, 10 years later, they were bought by Elon. So you can have it both ways. You can create the company, and then ultimately Pfizer can say, for example, you know, we like marketing your products. Or you know what? We'll start a conversation about marketing your product, and they'll go and say, you know, on their side, it makes more sense to actually own you lock, stock, and barrel. And typically for the company, it's a home run. Total, complete home run in that end. And so when you're an entrepreneur, you have to look at each of these options of going, but they're all based on succeeding at some level. They're based on getting started past
having a product that actually works.
Actually works, and having recognition in the marketplace and recognition in the investment community.
It sounds like it'd be a real boon to the consumer, though, because you've got a handful of companies that really have to focus on the business side of things, which is oftentimes one of the hardest things to do. And then you get scientists and people who really know what they're doing in a lab who can then focus on making drugs, right? They can focus on the things that they do best without ever actually having to worry about finding distributors and marketing and branding and all of that.
Well, that's when a company puts an infrastructure together, and they usually will have a marketing group within the company that makes that decision. Now, a lot of the venture and investment community that's part of the board, typically if there's a venture firm that's funded the company, they'll be on the board, and the board makes a decision on what kind of model. We don't get involved in the choice of models. Our job is to execute
on the model that they've already chosen. How early does a company need to bring Mentis in to do this?
This is really interesting because we get involved from what I call a Series A friends, even before that, a friends and family where we just created the company. We've had the privilege of naming five or six or seven companies in San Diego. So the company's not even been named yet at that side. And then we create a brand, at the more simplest level, a logo. But we typically do it with the roadshow at that point. Nowadays, absolutely the website. I would say that the website and brand is number one, the company. Because you can look, you can be nothing but three people, a business plan in a shared office, and can look like Pfizer. Mm-hmm. This is what the web's done to you today. And social media and digital marketing have enabled a very small enterprise to actually have the footprint of a multi-million dollar company on that side very easily.
So what you're saying, I think, is that you get involved very early on, not the back of the napkin stage where they're still designing the idea, but once they have the product kind of developed and they know where they're going with it, at that stage you can get involved.
Home run 100%. Because look at us as a packaging organization. But instead of packaging products, which we also do, but the reality is I think our forte is packaging companies at all stages of their enterprise.
Guy Iannuzzi is with us. Mentis is the company. We're talking about branding and investor relations, getting a company set to raise the capital they need to launch and build better companies. You're listening to Biz Talk. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
Don't go anywhere, folks. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. We're broadcasting today from the ESET studios, ESET Internet Security. Do more. Get a podcast of today's show and any of our previous shows. Now we're talking. Go to ESPN1700.com. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. Mentos is the company. Guy Iannuzzi is at the helm and the founder of the company. Guy, thanks for being here. You're a wealth of knowledge, absolute wealth of knowledge. And funny enough, I'm looking at your list of clients. You really do have clients that are the who's who of San Diego in technology, biotech, and a lot of other industries. But it's kind of funny. I looked at this list of over 30 companies here, and I'm sure it's not a complete list. At least 20 of those are people that we've interviewed over the years, which is really fascinating to me. So I'm enjoying hearing the work that you're doing with them. You are a branding and investor relations company, not necessarily a business to consumer. You're not really out there helping, say, WD-40 sell more lubricant to the right consumer, but you might help them raise the capital or have the investors. So you're in a niche that's not necessarily a consumer name.
That's correct. That is absolutely very accurate.
And we were talking about the branding and the marketing that you do. You have a really specialized kind of focus on helping companies. And I'm curious about the impact that you have here in the San Diego market. A lot of your clients are San Diego companies. We've talked often about the lack of capital for companies here in the San Diego area compared to, say, the Bay Area or Silicon Valley. Do you see that as an issue in Southern California versus some the mid-California area? Do you see the lack of capital here as an issue for the companies you support?
I hate to say it, but yes, it is a huge issue. And one of the things that I've said before, if you look at the normal number of companies that have been created in San Diego in the last four decades, it's thousands of companies, not hundreds, it's thousands of companies. And what's interesting is that now look at how many Fortune 500 companies have now been here, because that's the typical progression. Just two. And this is sad, because one of the jokes I have is that San Diego is the seventh, eighth largest city in North America. And my wife's hometown is Kansas City, which is a quarter our size, has 18 Fortune 500 companies.
Seriously, and we have two.
Yeah, and Houston, which is a city that's a little larger than San Diego, not very much. We're equivalent. It's number 8 or number 7, whatever.
I mean, we're number 4, actually.
Oh, they're number 4. Okay.
Yeah, Houston's huge, but I see where you're going.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
There's like 30, 40 Fortune 500 companies.
Wow.
And there's a reason. I mean,
hopefully they're still there.
Very good point.
Hopefully they are still there.
Very good point. No, there was a time, actually, we had more clients in Houston at one time than we had in San Diego, to be candid. And it's a great city for entrepreneurial development on that side, as is Texas and a lot of places there. San Diego has several problems in terms of entrepreneurial growth, not in creating companies from scratch. And it was a study.
So we can get companies incubated and started.
Bingo.
So you're saying there's a point at which we're restricted for the growth of that company. Is that completely due to the lack of capital? Or
no.
Are there other factors?
It's other factors, but the lack of capital is not a small measure of that. As you said, there's like people say, why is San Diego success? What is the reason? Well, there's many reasons that come together. And the lack of success in terms of the companies that get incubated here, Michael Porter in 2004, a study in Harvard, showed that San Diego's number one in the world in the formation of young companies from
Seriously?
Scratch.
Seriously?
Yeah, he did a study. And
so we're really good at the startup.
Oh, we're incredible at the startup. The problem is they don't last. These companies will reach a certain point and either sell out or, be acquired. And the acquisition thing we talked about.
Right.
And one of the comments I've said is, something I've observed, and I come from the marketing world, so you have to understand, and wrong or right, I see the world through marketing glasses. So to me, it's like, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail.
Right.
When you're a marketer, every problem is a marketing problem. Okay. So the reality is, I see this as a marketing problem. If you look at what happens when a company matures past a certain level, beyond mid-sized company, becomes a large company.
And you're talking about the 10 million level, 20, 50, 100 million?
50 to 100 million. Look at Qualcomm.
Okay.
Look at Qualcomm. Look at WD-40. Look at Sempra. Look at Illumina. Look at what was Life Technologies. Some of the companies that have succeeded very, very well. And you'll notice that Life Technologies has been acquired. You'll notice that a whole bunch of companies we've worked with, like Agron or whatever, are no longer companies on that side. They're owned by much larger companies. And one of the things we've seen looking at our technology brethren is that huge technology companies like Apple, HP, are no longer manufacturing companies. They don't manufacture anything. It's all outsourced. They're distribution and marketing and development companies. They have great prototypical, great R&D, and great, incredible marketing company. I mean, the reason Apple is Apple's number one company on the planet, and Steve Jobs is the reason, but Steve Jobs was a marketer. He was not a technician. When you reach a certain size as a company, you become a marketing company. And San Diego, I hate to say, is not a marketing center on the planet. And the lack of the marketing expertise here, the large companies that would bring the marketing infrastructure to the city, has prevented it from happening.
So is this a chicken and egg problem? Where
I was
going to
say, how do you fix it? Right, good point. Yeah.
Aaron, you're dead on, and it's back to the capital issue. Yeah. Okay, how do you attract? Well, there's several things that are a problem here. One, we're not in a mainstream area. I mean, we're sort of the
corner
of the U.S.
Geographically?
Geographically.
Because we're down in the bottom corner.
We're not
bounded
LA.
By Pendleton, the mountains, right. The ocean, and Mexico.
Yeah, but although nowadays with the internet and the way we it's one of the reasons Mentos could be a national agency, but we're just in San Diego. Still, it's a problem. It's a problem attracting the top marketing people. If you're a top marketing person nationally, you're not going to come
to San
Diego.
You don't think about San Diego as the
not
place you want to go.
Look
you think
at our
about
weather.
LA, New York, Chicago. What?
I said, well, look at our weather.
Yeah, only when you're retiring is it great. Right. If you're going to conquer the world as a marketing person, you really don't care about the weather. If I'm going to conquer the world, I'm going to be in New York or
you
San
care
Francisco,
about being
Chicago.
Around a lot of Fortune 500 companies.
Yeah.
And we just don't have them.
Yeah,
here.
The Mad Men were not based in San Diego. Okay.
So it is the chicken or the egg. Does the capital come first and then we attract them, or do we attract them and that brings the capital?
It's a long conversation on this one. We clearly can create companies from scratch and the companies can grow. And now you look at the microbreweries, for example, and look at Ballast Point. I mean, it's a $1 billion sale, which is unheard of.
Right.
You can do it here, but it got acquired. Because the larger
and that's
players,
what happens to every company
bingo.
That grows to a certain size. They get acquired or they move. Or
pushing a billion, pushing a few hundred million, and then you're not long for this world in that side. And it's devastating to Mentos because we tend to work with, because of our investor focus, we tend to work with the corporate headquarters. So when they're acquired, we lose them as clients on that end. So there's not an easy solution. I mean, it's something I think the city's aware of. The finance people are aware of. The people who are involved in a lot of the enterprises that we're talking about. I'm on the board of Biocom and some other organizations, and they're all completely aware of this problem. It's not an easy solution problem because ultimately, if you're running one of these companies, it's a mid-sized growing company, you have a fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders, to your company, to everybody else. And ultimately, but remember I said about an exit strategy.
Right.
What is in the best interest. And you can almost argue.
And I'm going to ask you to hold that because that's probably the best topic we've had so far this hour. I want to get back to that and maybe how we can develop the unicorns and the amazing companies here in San Diego. Guy Iannuzzi is with us. It is Mentos is his company. You're listening to Biz Talk. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
The best is yet to come. Don't you dare go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. Tomorrow's guests will include Spencer Hutchins from Concert Health and David Wirth with Fabricate Labs. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. We're glad you're with us. We were talking with Guy Iannuzzi. It's Mentos is his company. They're a branding and investor relations company that's really focused on helping companies work in the area of their own industry and raising capital, that kind of thing. Guy, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We were talking about the fact that we've got a problem here in San Diego that companies get to a certain size and they either stagnate or they do grow, but they get acquired, they move out. We don't have the big Fortune 500 companies for a lot of reasons, and it's not just the lack of capital. Over the break, we talked about land and other restrictions that we're having. It's a chicken or egg problem. If the capital comes in, maybe we could grow them. If we could grow them, maybe the capital's attracted. So what are the rest of the issues that we can solve? And I know we've only got a few minutes left,
sure.
So we can let's solve this problem in the next 6 minutes.
Well, this is a problem that actually the city's aware of. The mayor and the county and a lot of the larger company executives are involved. And some things are being done. Permitting processes have been made better. The
permitting to get the buildings
to get the buildings changed and grown with less of the infrastructure issues, less of the technical issues. Because at a certain level, the city competes. When somebody's creating a company, and you have to look at it in a national sense, when a venture firm funds an early stage company, they actually can tell the company, I want you to go. You're only three people. You're 10 people. You can be in Boston. You can be in... They can, and they have done that. Now, San Diego is the beneficiary of that. We've had, and I've been involved with several companies, startups companies, where the venture firm recommended they move to San Diego, and that's how we acquired them as a client. And because is the collaborative environment is very good for an early stage company in San Diego.
Especially in technology and biotech.
Exactly. Now, the problem is, past a certain point, that's not necessarily the case. And then a company wants to go past a certain level of size, there are challenges in San Diego. And this is, the cost of living is not a trivial one. You cannot live in San Diego at a lower level of income. You have to have a very high level of income to just survive in a housing sense.
Because a $500,000 house in Kansas City would probably buy what here? Nothing.
Nothing. I mean, and I just came from Kansas City a couple of weeks ago, and I'm very familiar with that. I had that conversation with several people in Kansas City. And that's actually very true. And this is a huge problem for a company that's growing, because right now, a growing technology company needs to recruit for talent. As a matter of fact, they need to recruit for everything. They need to recruit for talent, for sponsors, for investors on that end, for partners on that side. And to the extent that they can be within an ecosystem, and if you think of an ecosystem, and that's what San Diego is, and so is San Francisco, and so is Los Angeles, and so is the Bay Area, and so on. I mean, and
Boston and Charlotte. And
precisely. You have to then look at what makes it easier. Now, we're reaching a point where the cost of living here are becoming really prohibitive for a lot of companies to create a company. And there's some venture firms that are really concerned that funding a company here means that the burn rate would be spent in ways that don't build the enterprise. If your burn rate is double somebody else's because the cost of living is so high here, then why in God's name, if you're...
Because if you're attracting the best scientists in the world, they can live very comfortable in other parts of the country compared to here where they might not live as comfortably.
That is a problem. And so, granted, that's something we can't fix immediately. So the way you fix that is by making the other facets of the ecosystem more attractive. So, okay, granted, it's going to cost more to live here, but we're going to make it so that your permitting process is easier. The city infrastructure is all over you and giving you the credits that you need to grow the business. We're going to put together other support ecosystems, which San Diego's actually got. And you have organizations like Connect and Biocom and a whole range of other organizations that are doing an incredibly stand-up job in giving an early-stage entrepreneur the tools he or she need to get a leg up. It's like, I like to call it as the unfair advantage. And to the extent that somebody can give an entrepreneur an unfair advantage in succeeding with their company, you win on that end.
And so that's with the startup aspect of
precisely.
It. Precisely. But what you're saying is the $50 to $100 million company, that's where the struggle begins.
It is a struggle.
To get beyond that.
And it is a struggle, and I'll be candid. I've not heard and seen a lot of solutions, a lot of good ideas. It's a problem I think we all recognize at that side. And there's another component to this, which being in California does not help. Mm-hmm.
The regulations
that California have got that are pretty onerous and not getting better with time. And it's one of the reasons so many California companies and San Diego companies are moving to Texas. We're seeing that a lot in Nevada, whatever, for good reasons. And if I were to be creating such a company, I'd have a real hard time in my mind justifying the expense. Because I might say, you know, it's going to cost me 30% more to live and put the company in California because of these issues, the regulatory issues that come out of it, the political issues.
Well, just like permitting a house to be built here in San Diego might cost $80,000 just to get it entitled and permitted. Whereas if you go to Phoenix, that same house might have $20,000 of permit. So you can
I rest
get
my
a,
case.
Yes,
yeah.
You can get
and
a
I'm from Arizona. So and you have to understand when you create an enterprise, these are double. These are costs that are much broader than just a house. I mean, that's a wonderful example on that problem. And you have to understand that if you're struggling to raise $5 million and it's all you can do and you go crazy in 2 years to raise $5 million, every penny is incredibly valuable. And so that burn rate is something that's a really, really serious issue. And that's something that the city is, now, this is not guy talking. This is the city knows this. This is not something that is my observation. It's something everybody knows. So coming up with solutions, and on my personal belief, it's a branding marketing issue. Mm-hmm. We need to make the other components that we can
control,
make better.
Right.
so attractive, because no place is perfect.
Dan, when you're branding a company so that they can attract capital, have you ever looked at a situation and said, you know what, this isn't going to work in San Diego? We need to move them someplace else, or they need to look at some other city? Or have you been able to figure out a way, regardless of San Diego having the issues we have you always been able to figure out a way to get them the capital they need?
Well, basically, we again, our role, we don't get the capital. What we do is we give
you
them the tools
so that they
to
can
get
do
the
that.
Capital. I mean, I wish that was our role. Actually, it's not our role. We work with the people that help provide the capital on that side. Our job is to give the entrepreneur, they're usually the CEO and CFO of these companies, the founders, the tools they need, working with the venture firms also, to expand the capital for the company.
And is the capital there for the companies in San Diego?
That's a hard question. We don't have a lot of venture capital-based companies. We have a few, a handful of ones. We have a lot of offices for large major venture firms across the country, and all of them know where we are. And in certain market niches, they absolutely know where we are. So we
like
have
biotech.
Yes.
And
biotech and technology.
Two ones that, yeah.
Software, certain kinds of technologies, ag bio, some of the things you actually mentioned when I walked into the room, the algae area,
right,
for example, and clean tech. We have
Are there any benefits to the fact that companies get sold off and then you have these people, brilliant minds, going on to start company after a company?
Absolutely.
So there are. It's a double-edged sword, just like everything.
Well, it cuts both
ways.
They tend to stay. The unique part about San Diego is when somebody sells a company in Raleigh or in Charlotte, North Carolina, they tend to move. When somebody sells a company here,
the company tends to move, or
no,
the
individual.
The founders.
The founders. And so a lot of our clients are serial entrepreneurs who have been here for like 10, 20, 15 years. And the beauty is they'll create a second, a third, and a fourth company. Now, they just repeat the process, and we repeat the relationships. It's good for them, good for us in a certain respect, but I'm not sure that's necessarily good for the community in that context, because we need to have the maturity, and the ecosystem needs the mature, larger players along with, because I consider that a healthy ecosystem.
So we have a ways to go in,
yes,
San Diego to get the kind of business that, say, the Bay Area, some other areas have. Wow, there's a lot to do. Guy Iannuzzi, Mentis is your company. Thank you so much for being here. We'll have to have you back. There's a lot more I want to find out, because we didn't get to some of the questions that I found really fascinating. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
You folks have a great and prosperous day.